This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk about a couple things, shall we? Things that may seem like they're out of the news, but I waited to talk about these things until today for a reason. We're going to talk about things like drinking poison and specifically race communism. A lot of this is going to come back to that Carmelo Anthony trial from last week. Now, I know you're probably thinking, we should be talking about Iran and all this other stuff. We're going to get to Iran, the deal, whatever. We're going to get to all that in the show, I promise. But I wanted to talk about race communism because it's prevalent all over the United States of America. I didn't want to do it right after the trial when emotions were too high everywhere. I wanted everyone to calm down for a week and then have this conversation about what's happening in America, drinking poison, race communism, all these things. First of all, maybe in the wake of all the insanity post-Carmelo Anthony trial, maybe you are sitting there thinking to yourself, this is unique to America. This is unique to Black America. This is, you know, whatever the case may be. Please understand that race communism was used all the time by the Soviets. The Bolsheviks used it all the time. Mao used it all the time. Race communism is, you'd call it one of the base tenets of communism. Why is that the case? Okay, so let me explain it this way. Communists, as you know, they thrive on malcontented people, miserable people. Communism is the religion of the malcontent. That's how I've always described it. That's how I've always defined it. All right, so you got that. Communism is the religion of the malcontent. We got that. All right, malcontented people, miserable people. This is not universal at all, what I'm about to say, but it is true in lots of the cases. Lots of times, those are stupid people. Really, really dumb, low-end, bottom-of-the-barrel people. You know somebody like this in your life. He's been on welfare 35 years. He's got an IQ of about 55. He, of course, has never done anything wrong. The man has always held him down. You understand what I mean? That's a perfect communist recruit right there. Well, dumb people are always, always more susceptible to all this racial war crap you've seen throughout history. Dumb people lap that stuff up of every skin color, every single one. You want to go IQ test the KKK from 1920? It's going to be the dumbest group of people in the world. Fast forward to today, all these Black civil rights activists out there pretending like they care about Black people, IQ test them, the dumbest people in the world. Back in the Soviet Union, when they were telling them, you are guilty, these people are guilty of oppressing your group, and if you elect me, then I will smack the dumbest people in the world. They're the ones who hoover this stuff up. I mean, do you see this video from CB? Listen to this.
My son didn't intend to hurt anyone. My son was defending himself.
Take us inside that courtroom. What stuck out to you?
What stuck out to me, number one, was the all-white jury. But I was trying to be, you know, like, all right, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, the truth is on our side.
My son didn't intend to hurt anyone. Who would believe that? A moron. It was an all-white jury. We know the makeup of the jury. There was an Indian in there, Asians, Middle Eastern. It was not an all-white jury. But who would believe that? Really, really, really stupid people. Stupid people are susceptible to race communism. They always have been and always will be. And as long as you have a high enough percentage of stupid people in your society, communists are going to use race communism to divide and conquer. And that's in the end what all this is about. It's never been about white or black or Asian or Mexicans or whatever the case may be. It's always simply about elite communists trying to get power. And always one of the most effective ways to get power is you, all of you, your victims, them, those are the bad guys. You elect me and I'll go hurt the bad guys on your behalf. That is race communism at its core. It has always been used and always will be. Now, to the poison part of all this, let's talk about it in practical terms. That's kind of like the 30,000 foot view. Let's talk about this in practical terms. What does this mean for a society? Well, this is poison. Let me tell you something about you. You probably already know, because it's true of you. It's true of me. It's true of every human being on the face of the planet. We are swayed by what goes into our eyes and our ears, by what we consume. What you watch, what you listen to, what you read, that is going to affect you. It is going to have a real effect on your mind, on your outlook in the world. And if you are drinking poison with your eyes and ears, let's say, for instance, a bunch of influences in your life have been feeding you poison over and over and over and over and over again, you will obviously and inevitably be poisoned. Your very soul will be twisted and poisoned. And people from the outside looking in will be able to see it, but you won't. This has become a gigantic problem for portions, not all, for portions of the Black community in the United States of America. And it's because of how many people of high influence in their lives push lies and poison all the time. They get it from Black media sources. They get it from white media sources. They get it from Black entertainers. They get it from Black athletes. They get it from Black pastors. They get it from Black politicians. On and on and on down the list. Poison and lies, poison and lies, poison and lies. And it's destroying people. Speaking of that all-white jury lie, here was Don Lemon.
They struck the three Black jurors. It was an all-white jury. 17-year-olds make horrible decisions.
Right.
I'm not saying that they should not be accountable, held accountable in some way for what they do. But a 17-year-old in 35 years, it just doesn't sit right with me.
Listen, if you asking me, I don't think that all white people should be able to do anything in secret at all. I don't think they should have. I don't think they should be able to have drapes or curtains. Everything should be clear, because anytime, let me tell you something. When it's all white people in secret, it's bad for everybody. I think that striking those jurors that were Black was for a reason.
Well, he's right about the last point. They struck the Black jurors because the Black jurors, prospective jurors, came out and said they were going to acquit him because he's Black. How could you do that? Acquit somebody because they share the same skin color? Well, poison. That guy, D.L. Hughley, right there. White people shouldn't be able to do anything in secret. How could you say something like that? He spent his entire life drinking poison, going into his eyes and his ears. Speaking of Black comedians, I went to a Black comedy show one time here in Houston. My wife and I went out to a Black comedy show. For the most part, guy was very funny. At one point in time, he tried to do this super serious routine, and he got on stage and he started to opine about how white people are arming themselves in preparation for a race war against Black people in the United States of America. This was not a comedy bit. He believed it. And he just wanted everybody to know that that is what's coming. How could you believe something so stupid, something so wrong, something so insane? You've been drinking poison your whole life, poison. It's got to stop. Poured poison poured into the Black community in this country. Did you see these two?
This was always about race. It was always about race. It was always about race. The moment that a Black boy had the nerve to protect himself against a white aggressor, It was always about race.
What it is going to take in order for us to get under from under our oppressor's thumb. They are going to be violent anyway. So why would we continue to be peaceful martyrs to keep capitalism and white supremacy going? We cannot live like this. This is not sustainable.
Black women, especially black women who have black male children, live in fear and agony every single day. A fear and agony that I promise you, the Metcalfs probably never spent a day living that way. And we're going to have just some real conversations about race in this country.
That's poison. If that's how your mother raised you, if that's how your pastor spoke to you on Sundays, if that's how the musicians you listen to speak, the athletes you cheer for speak, and you've spent 10 years, 20 years, 30, 40, 50, 60 years consuming that poison, you will be poisoned in the end. And what's that look like? Well, this is what it looks like.
What do you want us to do? What do you want us to do at this point? What? I'm lost for words. I don't know what to do. I got 5 boys. I don't know what. I ain't got nothing to tell them no more. You can't walk away no more.
Ain't no f***ing judicial justice for black people. How many decades and decades have to go by where you don't receive that? Your justice is f***ing frontier justice. They f***ing one of y'all. You f***ing one of them.
If evidence does come out that Carmelo was not in fact fighting for his life when he stabbed and killed Austin Metcalf, do you think that the black community will accept that?
If evidence shows that he did not, no, we're going to stand by ours regardless. They stand by theirs. We're going to stand by ours regardless.
All those people, you can hate them, love them, whatever, they've all simply been poisoned. It's got to stop. It's got to stop. And to be clear, it not only has to stop for the health of our nation, it has to stop for the health of the black community. When I say poison, this is a deadly poison. If you consume it long enough, your soul is going to rot away. It's got to stop. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. Catalina Lauf knows a bit about this stuff. We'll talk to her in just a moment. Before we talk to Catalina, last night was Sunday. There was a big UFC fight. Yeah, I watched a bit of it. I was a little amped up by the time it was done, and I was sitting there thinking to myself, not going to be able to sleep. But Beam took care of that. Specifically, Dream Powder from Beam took care of that. I had a cup of hot chocolate during the last fight. Sipped on a little cup of hot chocolate, but it was special hot chocolate, Dream Powder. It was chocolate cinnamon, had all sorts of natural things in it. When the fight was over, I crawled into bed and I was out like that. Felt like $1 million today. How'd you feel? Shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. We'll be back. Well, speaking of poison, I'm still blown away by how gross our cities have become in this country, our wonderful cities. You know, you want your cities to be good. But instead, this guy's the mayor of Chicago.
The president has always been intimidated by the intellectual prowess of black men.
I've been very intentional about making sure that my administration, unlike previous administrations, have people who work for me that reflect the community. Once upon a time, just to be very blunt with you, 2 administrations ago, 70% of the mayor's administration were white men, right? And that's just not a diversified approach, I believe.
And you just watched an entire city council, in transparency, try to take wages away from the very people who are part of an industry that has its ties to slavery. Nobody's hiding from that. I am boldly declaring that we need reparations in this city, and that's why I'm funding it.
We cannot incarcerate our way out of violence. We've already tried.
Joining me now, candidate for Congress in Florida, Catalina Lauf, and author of the book Time to Choose. Hey, Catalina, why are you in Florida now instead of living under that? You didn't enjoy that?
Hey, Jesse, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I'm a proud blue state refugee, along with the 2 million other people who have fled cities like Chicago and LA and all of these disgusting, once beautiful, but very disgusting cities now because of horrible leadership. And look, it's a shame to watch some of the country's most beautiful areas be completely dismantled and just put to ruin because of liberal policies. And it's only going to continue to happen if people like Brandon Johnson and Karen Bass continue to have these regimes where, you know, crime rates are up, the homelessness crisis is through the roof, you know, people are getting shot at constantly. You know, we don't have those problems in Southwest Florida. We live in one of the safest counties in the country. Why? Because we have great leadership.
I want you to talk about the differences in leadership, because I just got back from Tokyo a little bit ago, 36 million people. I didn't see a cigarette butt on the sidewalk. There's no crime. People leave their phones on the table when they go to the bathroom. So it's clearly possible. It's possible in Southwest Florida. It's possible in Tokyo. What's going on in Chicago? What happens that turns these places dangerous?
You know, it's part, I don't want to, you know, just say that it's pure evil, because there is an element to that, but it's also just genuine incompetence. You know, when everything is centered around race and people are put in positions where it has nothing to do with experience or background, no matter what their race is or what, you know, gender they identify with. When you have people who are incredibly experienced with what they do, for example, you know, when we have great sheriffs here in Southwest Florida, you have great local leadership, and also in the current Congressman Byron Donalds, you know, again, you don't see this stuff in places where you have competent leadership. And when you don't have just this political agenda that the woke left and the radical left have tried to implement in every single place that they are in, quote unquote, leadership in, it's disgraceful. You know, you have people like Karen Bass and the mayor in Chicago, where they just don't care. You know, they're just sitting there. It's for themselves. They're in the position where it's a completely selfish, for completely selfish reasons, while their entire cities crumble. And so, again, it's part evil, part incompetence, I truly believe.
Why don't they care? How could you look at your policies causing so much suffering? I mean, people die. This is people's lives. So much suffering, so much misery, and it just doesn't affect you? I guess I can't. I'm a selfish jerk. I don't even understand that way of thinking. Can you explain that?
You know, in a lot of ways, it's unexplainable, because I can't imagine why people in those positions would ever allow, let's say, even the border crisis to happen in these cities are sanctuary cities, for example, and you have Americans that have died in at the hands of illegal immigrants. You have crime rates that are soaring. Again, you're right. Absolutely right, Jesse. People have died. And so either they live in their own crazy dystopian world where they just don't believe that their policies are a direct result of, the consequences are a direct result of their policies, or they're completely just bought by a political movement, the Marxist movement, that is trying to infiltrate all of our cities. They're paying and having running campaigns to have corrupt judges in these cities. They're sweeping things under the rug at the expense of the American people. And ultimately, I hate to say this, but it's got to get so bad in some of these cities for people to finally wake up and push back. Look at what's happening in LA. You know, Spencer Pratt almost won that. And it's because people were so fed up with what's going on. He probably did win that for clearly, but you know, places like New York and Chicago, they still have to have that awakening moment. And I think we'll get there. And it's just so sad that it has to take something so detrimental for that to happen.
You mentioned the radical left and the Karen Bass types and the Brandon Johnson types. I'm concerned that that has become mainstream and it's no longer radical in the Democrat Party. I just don't see that much difference between the older statesman Democrats and the AOCs of the world. They all seem to take the same position on things. I feel like that's just Democrats now.
You're absolutely right. I mean, look at, you know, Mondami in New York City. Look at Graham Plantner over there in Maine. You know, this is the bench that the Democratic Party has. And again, I do believe that the more they try to run candidates like this, and the more that we enact things like, you know, voter ID laws and election integrity, the more that the Republican Party can combat sort of the mechanics of voting. And then also the fact that the Democrats are running these types of candidates, I think people are actually independents and sane, moderate Democrats look at candidates like that and they're disgusted by it. And you're absolutely right. Nancy Pelosi is no different from AOC, even though, you know, they have 60 years in between. And so you're absolutely right. This is not JFK's party. This is not the Democratic Party of our grandparents' generation. These are Marxists. These are Marxist people. And in some cases, there are members of Congress who actively hate this country and the American people. And the more that we have to do our job as people to not only elect better people, but even in the Republican Party, we need to make sure that we have the best fighters up against these Marxists, because it's happening all across the board. And you're absolutely right. It's just who they are as a party now.
Tell me about Florida. Tell me about your race, because I just got back from Florida last week and it's really friggin' nice down there. And I'd really like to not see it go to absolute crap.
Yeah, no, you are. I hope you enjoyed it. First of all, we welcome you down here anytime. It is truly paradise. I will tell you, there's such a difference being a blue state refugee. I mean, I live near, you know, people that I grew up with in Illinois. This part of Southwest Florida is very Midwestern. Actually, you go on the other side, it's a lot more of the East Coast population, but this side is very much Midwestern. So it's very natural for a Midwesterner and Midwesterners in general to be blue state refugees and come down here. And I say that because we who have fled blue states, with victory comes vigilance. And we will not allow a state like Florida to become a state like Illinois or California. You know, just 6 years ago, Florida almost had a Democratic governor. And so obviously things have changed significantly, but we need to make sure that we are trending in the right direction. We cannot sit complacently. We cannot sit comfortably. And so I'm so proud, you know, I decided I didn't want to raise my kids in a place where there were, you know, feminine products and boys' bathrooms. That doesn't happen here in Florida, but I'll make sure that it never happens here. And so I'm really proud to be running in Southwest Florida. We have established roots down here. We've been coming here for decades vacationing, and it was about time that we transferred everything over once and for all.
Good for you. Enjoy the beach. Catalina, come back. Appreciate you.
Thanks so much.
All right. We had a UFC event last night. It was friggin' awesome. I hope you had a chance to, at least if you didn't watch it, at least catch some of the highlights with the flyovers and whatever. We're going to talk to Josh about it in just a moment. Before we do that, let me talk to you about your mobile provider. It's the month of June, right? Except lots of corporate America has declared this month to be Pride Month. What's your cell provider? What are they doing this month? I don't have to worry about Pure Talk, you see. My company, Pure Talk, their CEO fought for this country in Vietnam. They are all about America, the troops, the red, white, and blue. Last Independence Day, they were sending out free American flags to veterans. What's your mobile provider doing this month? Oh, by the way, I pay way less than I used to pay. Switch to Pure Talk. You keep your phone, you keep your number. It's easy to switch. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. Well, one of the things I really enjoyed about that UFC event from last night is just how patriotic it is. You can call me hokey or whatever it is, but I'm that guy who still gets a little misty sometimes during the national anthem. I like celebrations of my country. I cheer for them. I think we should do more of that. Patriotism, remember, is the essential element for a nation. With it, you're going to be fine. Without it, we're in trouble, which brings me to the latest poll showing that 30% of Democrats are extremely proud to be Americans. That is a big problem for the United States of America. Joining me now, Joshua Lysak. He's been a ghostwriter for 15 years. He has one out soon called Stay Off My Kitchen Table, which we'll get to in just a few. Joshua, you're a student of history. You understand what happens when a nation's citizens stop loving it. It's not good.
Yes, what we're currently experiencing right now is a sort of a protracted, multi-decades-long cultural Marxist indoctrination and subversion campaign through all of the institutions up to and of course, including education, which has resulted in the indoctrination of generation upon generation upon generation now of young, soon to be, and now older Americans who, when they think about American history, they don't think as much about 1776 as they do about 1619 or 1863 or 1964, these eras that are only seen through the lens of oppressor versus oppressed, which of course comes from classical Marxism. We understand, and we talk about this in a number of books that Jack and I have done in other projects where, and of course you, Jesse, with the Anti-Communist Manifesto, that economic Marxism was this idea that people who owned the stuff oppressed the people who did not own anything. And it was that power difference that made up all issues in society. And therefore, the proletariat, the poor, had to revolt and overthrow by any means necessary those power holders, that is, the bourgeois, those who were the landowners, the factory owners, and so on. Over the centuries, two centuries specifically, that is mutated into cultural Marxism, which recasts the rich and the poor as the straight and the gay, as men and women, as white and black. And in some cases, you have the United States government against any group that has, let's say, a grievance against the government, be it Indians or any other group, and they will kind of coalesce into a coalition of the fringes, and then they have subverted American education. So now, proud to be an American, oh, you mean proud of being a white heterosexual oppressor of all of these poor women, gays, Indians, and so on and so forth? Yeah, I'm not going to be proud of that. That is the message that has been inculcated across at least three generations now.
It seems so nakedly poisonous that I'm actually surprised, Joshua, that more people don't see it, because that's what it is. And frankly, correct me if I'm wrong, that's what it's designed to be. It's designed to be a poison that breaks up and degrades the country and eventually kills the country. That's its whole purpose.
Yes, that's right. I mean, many of us remember growing up back when we consumed media from the 1950s and 1960s, where we had characters like Davy Crockett, fictional ones like the Lone Ranger and Tonto, for example, where there was some sense of an American story, the American experience before the West was won, and it was very simply just the Wild West. Those were our grandparents' grandparents. And many of us, fortunately, were able to have conversation with those people about what it was like. There's one in particular story from a family member where their, I believe it was their great-grandfather during the time of the Great Depression moved out to the plains, probably the worst place you could move to at that time, with literally no money. So no money, not even any coins. There's no banks. There's no opportunity for welfare. There's no food stamps. There's no gimmies and stimmies and freebies and handouts that a nation of immigrants, we all hear now, that's what they're coming here largely for, not to stake their claim in Oklahoma or go up the Oregon Trail and have a ranch up there. They're just here for you know, basically to be drains on the American taxpayer. But these are who these people were, living on the edge between civilization and the chaos and danger of the wilderness. And I'm from Ohio, and we have so many lost and forgotten little markers about such and such frontiersman or adventurer who lived here, came here, got massacred by Indians, war came in, there was fighting, and there was intercultural exchange, if you could call it that. And that is unfortunately largely lost to the next generations. And if you don't have family stories, if you don't have that legacy, that's one of the reasons I became a ghostwriter, by the way, is to kind of have a vein of patriotism that would document so many of these stories for so many families that has been forgotten But frankly, it's up to us now to continue these stories on and to support demonstrations of patriotism that inculcate the next generation with the depth of what the American experience is. It's an experience of pride in masculinity, a pursuit of excellence, and what happiness looks like. And sometimes that's going to be a ranch with cattle in northern Texas, or it's going to be a beautiful little cottage on a lake in southwest Ohio, or it can be putting men on the moon or the first man on Mars, where there needs to be the American flag. Thank you, Elon Musk.
Okay. Tell me about Stay Off My Kitchen Table. What is this?
Yes, I like to think of this as the unofficial MAHA guidebook. One of my own experiences that I have is as a sufferer of chronic veganism for 10 years. And by the way, we talk about subversion, we talk about cultural Marxism. It turns out that the plant-based diet where, the healthiest thing that you can do as an American is to eat soybeans instead of good American ground beef. It turns out that that is also a demonstration of cultural Marxism. We even have dietary subversion. Imagine that. Well, the idea there is that human beings are the oppressors and animals are the oppressed. Many vegans will call themselves abolitionists, to use the moral language of slavery and some in the pro-life movement, this belief that they need to engage in revolutionary activities. So PETA protesters and whatnot will regularly engage in violence, very much like a reactionary quasi-communist type. Now, I did experience that diet and a number of symptoms like you might imagine from that. But as my symptoms of chronic veganism did, let's say, develop over a number of years, I began to look into personally and then professionally as a ghostwriter and then as a co-author of this book, I would look into what makes a food healthy or not healthy. And we're now at a time where the official dietary guidelines via the Department of Health and Human Services, thank you, RFK Jr., say that the best meat, the best protein, of course, comes from animal products. The healthiest diets that you can possibly have are those that are based around animal protein. But why? Why is, let's say, an ounce of ground beef superior to a same ounce of soybean food product? Why specifically? Well, questions of bioavailability, nutrient absorption, the presence of anti-nutrients, this quite interesting and fascinating nerdy food chemistry subject matter begins to come up. And I begin documenting all of my findings. And I kind of tracked my own experiences going out of veganism to a very much make America healthy again, more like make Joshua healthy again at that time, dietary paradigm. And I begin documenting all of my improvements, changes, and successes. And then I teamed up with a physician in Florida, Dr. Philip Avedia. He's the most widely followed heart doctor on all social media. And we have created this great, exciting work that's coming out in July that it basically points out the foods that are healthiest, why they're healthiest, and what are those foods that communist subversives on behalf of the Marxist vegan agenda are pushing on Americans. Well, what is the truth versus what is the error? And because dietary subversion happens, just like in education and every other domain, we do have to relearn what it means to be quote unquote healthy. And it's probably not eating tofu, America.
I promise it's not eating tofu. Joshua, thank you, my brother. I appreciate that. Stay Off My Kitchen Table is the name of the book. Go pre-order that bad boy. Now, do you have high interest debt? Do you have a mortgage and high interest debt? I know I'm not going to tell you that's good news. I know, but there's a light at the end of the tunnel. There's no story you have that American Financing hasn't heard before. American Financing will create a path forward for you, a way out of the dark. It feels like you're never going to get out, but Jesse, you don't understand. I owe this. I'm paying 28%. Jesse, you don't know. They've heard it all, and they've helped people just like you navigate their way out of it. Go look them up. AmericanFinancing.net/Jesse. AmericanFinancing.net/Jesse. We'll be back. Well, maybe you've heard the news of the day is the whole Iran dust up is over, kind of over. I'm not sure exactly what we're calling it. Looks like everybody, all sides have signed on the dotted line. We don't have the details yet because they haven't released the deal, but it looks like some funds are going to be released to Iran. Look, it all comes down to this. If you wanted this thing to end, you're probably relatively happy. If you wanted this thing to keep going until there was no more Iranian regime, you undoubtedly have the vapors today. Look, war's ugly. Ending wars are ugly. We'll see what Mike has to say about it. Joining me now, host of the President's Daily Brief, Mike Baker, former CIA covert operations officer, by the way. All right, Mike, I know we don't have the T's that have been crossed and the I's that have been dotted because we don't have the actual details yet. What do you know? What do you think?
Yeah, I think to your point, I don't think anybody's going to be really happy once they see how this shakes out. But that's just me being churlish. Look, according to latest reports, both sides have electronically signed the deal. The problem is, what does each side think they're signing? Because we haven't seen the exact text of this. We've seen some leaked drafts past week or so, and those have been kind of at odds with each other, depending on which leaked draft you've seen. Now it looks like the Iranians are saying, well, as part of this deal, we get half of our roughly $24 billion that are in frozen assets before we start the other negotiations. And they're saying that Lebanon is included in this, meaning there'll be no more hostilities between Israel and Lebanon. If you talk to the American side, they're like, no, we're not giving up any funds at all until, they demonstrate good faith, which they never have, but okay, let's set that point aside. And they're saying also, that Israel and Lebanon are, going to stop fighting. The only problem there is Israel is not party to this agreement. The Lebanese government doesn't speak for Hezbollah. Hezbollah is not part of this agreement, has already indicated they're not stopping. And so I don't know. There's a lot of confusion here. And at the end of the day, if the U.S. government gives up roughly $12 billion to get some conversation going down the road about their nuclear program in exchange for getting the Strait of Hormuz opened to where it was prior to the conflict. That's why I say I don't know that anybody's going to be happy with this.
Okay, Mike, so if this is an outcome, and I totally agree with you, that nobody's satisfied with, nobody's going to be happy with the whole thing, and that's if it all works out the way they think it's going to work out, which, again, as you pointed out, is very much up in the air, I'm going to assume, and I think it's probably fairly safe to assume, that in a private moment, Donald Trump probably wishes he'd never gone on this little adventure because we're worse off in every possible way than we were before. Why did he do it? I'll put it this way. What do you think he foresaw this thing ending like? What do you think he wanted out of it?
Well, I think he felt, probably because there were a small cadre of individuals around him telling him, you saw what happened in Venezuela. Boy, that sure worked out great. We can do the same thing as combination of military and economic pressure. We can clean up this Iranian regime mess. It's gonna work out well. Because you remember at the very beginning of this conflict, the president was talking about a matter of days, right? And then was talking about we're obliterating their military capabilities. We're decimating their nuclear program. We're going to get them to stop promoting and supporting terrorist proxies. None of that happened. Look, I believe firmly that the Iranian regime deserves to have the ass kicking of all time and should be gone. But I worry that there was some, I don't want to say hubris, but there was a little intoxication left after the success of that Venezuelan effort, which continues to work in the favor of the US at this point. And I think that kind of led them down this path, perhaps. I don't know that. I know they talked about the intel saying, look, there's an imminent threat here with their nuclear program. That's open to interpretation. Everyone's got a different definition of imminent threat. So why did they do it? I think they were overly optimistic. I don't think they listened to all the input that was coming in from the intel community and the military and the Pentagon. So that's just me sitting on the sidelines being churlish.
Okay, let's focus on just two more points here. The Iranian military. I have to assume that Trump thinks or knows, you'll know much more about this than I will, that Iran, they're not ended. Their military is not ended. Yeah, we crushed their Navy, we crushed their Air Force, but they've also shot down two of our planes in recent weeks. I have to assume that Iran had some leverage still with some kind of defense that's still functioning, right?
Yeah, I think, look, the White House has been keen to get out of this conflict for quite some time. And the White House also tends to speak in rhetoric, right? So the idea that we've decimated there, we're in full control. We're not in full control of the Strait of Hormuz, despite what, you know, Pete Hegseth or the president may say. If we were, we wouldn't be having this conversation. They wouldn't, you know, have approached this deal the way they did, because we would have had full control of the Strait. So that was a key leverage point. I think, you know, it was clear that the regime wasn't going anywhere. You can't change that regime just by dropping bombs from the air. And nobody was willing to go that next step, because that's a massive, you know, leap to say we're going to put boots on the ground to try to effect regime change. So that wasn't going to happen. And I think at a certain point, you know, here comes the midterm elections. I know the president said he doesn't care about the midterm elections, but you know what a lot of people in Washington do, and I suspect he does as well, as you said in his private moments. And so I think they would just, let's make a deal. Let's try to figure out some way that we can make a deal to spin this as a win. And of course, the problem is that's what the Iranian regime is also attempting to do. And from the Iranian regime's perspective, they're still in existence. So they, in their minds, I know this sounds illogical, because they did suffer significant military damage, right? We did a lot of harm to their military, but they still do have defense capabilities. It's not true when they say they have no defenses. They've retained a significant amount of their missile stockpile and launchers and capability to disrupt the Strait of Hormuz. And so in the Iranian regime's mind, again, as illogical as it sounds, they think they've got the upper hand. And they're painting it this way to their people. The Iranian state media, the leadership, they're saying, look, we forced the U.S. to end this war.
All right, my final one from me. The United States of America's relationship with Israel, it's long, long complicated history, but it's hard to see any kind of a great future for that, especially now. Israel doesn't want this thing to end. Israel is obviously and understandably invested in the complete destruction of the Iranian regime. They're, like you pointed out, they're not going to back off of getting Hezbollah off their borders. That is very much going to put them at cross purposes with Trump and American interests. This relationship, I'm not saying it's over, not at all, but it feels like we just had our first big fight and it's going down a bad path.
Yeah. Look, I think it's just points to the reality of any relationship between two nations, right? You've got a Venn diagram where the interests you collide, where they're the same. And then you've got a lot of interests that are in line with that particular nation's best interests. And look, Israel approaches this whole thing from their own particular point of view, which frankly, a lot of people in the West, in the US, have a disagreement with, but that's because they don't have that experience. We don't have that shared experience of being surrounded by a daily existential threat. And so whether you agree with it or not, you have to step back a moment and say, okay, they approach this problem from their perspective, just like the US does from its own perspective, right? That's just the way the world works. So I think, yes, has it harmed the relationship? Honestly, you know, long-term, no. You know, mid-term, no. I think it's just behind the scenes, the militaries, the intel services, government-to-government relations, it's all fairly pragmatic. And particularly with Israel, there's always been this sense that, yeah, we're going to have different interests at times. And this is one of those real fundamental times when Israel says, no, we haven't decimated their military capabilities. They still want to wipe us off the face of the earth, as the Iranian regime has said many times, as has Hezbollah and others. And so you know, they're going to approach this from their own best interests, as every nation tends to.
No doubt. Mike, come back, my brother. I appreciate you very much. All right, it's time to lighten the mood. And I mentioned earlier in the show the UFC event from last night. Maybe you're not into the whole fighting thing. That's fine. I get all that. That's certainly not going to be something for everybody. But I'll tell you what, it was cool having it at the White House. It felt patriotic. And the flyover portion from last night, man, if this didn't give you goosebumps, I would check and make sure you have a pulse. Was awesome. I'll see you tomorrow.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty on Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty on demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.